Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hi, this is Leszek Jaszewski, editor-in-chief of Liberté and the host of the Liberal Europe podcast. Please do tune in for our conversations on Visegrad Insight podcast with Wojciech Przybylski about Europe's future, strategic autonomy, and fruitful discussion about the challenges for the world on defense and foreign policy. It'll be my pleasure. Thank you.
The 21st of August, I'm Miles Maftian, sitting here with Adam Yassed, and we're trying to bring you the latest developments around the region from a very hot and muggy Warsaw.
Hello.
The talk of the region is on the upcoming elections in Slovakia and in Poland, obviously. Last week, we focused a great deal on, you know, the elections and the forthcoming elections in Poland. So I was kind of interested in diving a bit more into Slovakia. And obviously there's some interesting breaking news out of Slovakia that we covered in our weekly outlook, which is out now on Visegrad Insight. So we saw that several high profile current and former intelligence and security officials have been detained and charged over alleged links to organized crime. Now these developments have ratcheted up tensions in a nation that's already on edge as it's heading to the polls. And if that wasn't enough, the leading contender for the September 30th vote, ex-Prime Minister Robert Fico, he's fired back and he's accusing the police and the current caretaker government of what he terms a coup against democracy, nonetheless. So there was a swift response. The government convened the Security Council last Friday. Their message, police work is above politics and should be allowed to proceed without tampering. So I'm just kind of curious, what's your thoughts here, Adam? Because I know that right now you're writing a piece, or you finished writing a piece, and it's going to be coming out this week. Our listeners should wait for this piece, which is coming out on Wednesday. So just tell us a bit, what do you think about this escalating tensions there?
Well, the political situation has been febrile in Slovakia for a long time.
Right.
And it's all marked by Fico's temperament and desire to return to power. Just to remind everyone, he was prime minister for many years at the Kadeco and was forced out of the office by a scandal surrounding the murder of Jan Kuciak and his girlfriend, his fiancée, which had all the marks of a mafia killing, if mm-hmm. you will. You know, he was publishing uncomfortable details of the patronage network, corruption networks involving politicians and some business people. And it was a moment of reckoning for the Slovak citizens. There were huge protests in the street, and in the end, you know, Fico was using actually the same argument that this was a coup.
Right.
Trying to get him out of power. In the end, he had to resign. A more sort of transparent pro-Western government was installed. But that government very quickly, for different reasons, lost steam. And last December, it lost a confidence vote. Early elections were called. And Fico is now leading the opinion polls to return to power. And you know, his type of sort of campaigning and politics is very much sort of misrepresenting his political opponents as enemies of Slovakia. And he's turning arguments on its head, like now he's talking about a coup against democracy just
sure.
because police is investigating
sure.
senior officials. The truth is that some of these former officials were members of his administration. So obviously he's fearful about the impact this is going to have on his electoral chances. And you know, opinion polls suggest that although he's in front, it's a tight race mm-hmm. and he may struggle to put together a majority. Just to give you an example, you know, many analysts in Slovakia expect him to team up with extreme right parties. But that's sort of, okay, he can be ruthless in his desire to regain power. But at the same time, this is going to complicate matters for him because he's part of the European Socialist Group in the European Parliament. He doesn't want to give that up.
Yeah.
So an alliance with the far right, that is going to be a complication.
Yeah.
And, you know, despite his fiery rhetoric and really vitriolic language, his past record also indicates that on the European level, he can be quite pragmatic.
Right.
So, for example, if he's now using slightly anti-Ukrainian or Ukrainian skeptical language to differentiate himself from the current pro-Ukrainian government, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually change completely or the policies later on, or to upset some kind of European consensus on how to proceed with Ukraine, that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
So he can be pragmatic,
mm-hmm.
if only to maintain his connections within the socialist grouping in the European Parliament. And another thing to remember is that Slovakia is a small economy. It's a nation of 5.5 million people. It's in the Eurozone. And there is a limit to what it can sort of achieve going against the current. So if
right.
the majority of European states want to support Ukraine and want sanctions on Russia, we have to see if Fico, if he is in power again, if he's really prepared to go the Viktor Orban way and hijack and jeopardize and undermine the European unity.
Yeah, and today the National Assembly is convening to have this extraordinary session, and the session's been called on by Fico Smer, and it's supported by this coalition of political parties that you were essentially talking about, right? So the far right, Republika, even the neo-fascist LSNS, Smer's offshoot party Hlas, and the conservative populist group.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong in having a parliamentary
of
discussion.
Course
not. So the fact that these parties chose not to oppose such a extraordinary
right.
hearing is not unusual. This is still part of the democratic
right.
process. And in a sense, it's you
yeah.
could even argue that with an event of this scale,
of
parliament should sort of have a sitting.
But their demand is clear, right?
But obviously the intention is clear.
Yeah.
However, it can backfire.
Of course.
Because if the government is able to demonstrate that there is some nasty stuff going on in
yeah.
the secret services, and that it sort of, in a greater picture of things, this is part of the past under
right.
Fico,
right.
then it can backfire on him. So
yeah.
You know, there is some political maneuvering on both sides around this issue, but I would argue, and this is a long shot, that Fico is more scared of this development than actually sees this as an opportunity, because it's a reminder of where Slovakia was when he was in power.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting where it's heading, too. I mean, I think a lot of people who may not know so much about Slovakia and are just hearing about this, they think there's this interim government and that they are essentially trying to, you know, some of what Fico is saying, for those who do not really know the background of this, they might think, well, yeah, this interim government's coming in and all of a sudden trying to disrupt the democratic process and so forth. Why now? Why not after?
Why not before? Why is it happening two months before the vote?
Yeah, but you know, the argument there is pretty clear. I mean, you go to the polls and you want to have the best information as a voter, right? So if they uncover something that really shows these ties, then me as a voter, I would want to obviously know about this as opposed to not know, and then we're thrown into some other another special election 2-3 months down the line.
I agree with you. And the burden of proof is on the government.
Right.
You know, or the police in that matter.
Exactly.
If the police can convincingly demonstrate that they have hard evidence of wrongdoing, then the timing doesn't matter.
Correct.
If this is all allegations, circumstantial evidence, and a weak case in general,
mm-hmm.
then the suspicions that this is election interference.
Yeah.
Gain credibility. So,
yeah, so from both sides,
yeah.
there are really high stakes, and it's
yeah, exactly.
in this charged atmosphere, it's really something. So, yeah, the only other, I think, bigger news that we were focusing on from our newsroom is just that Erdogan went and visited Hungary, right, to essentially discuss with Orban their strategic partnership and so forth. You know a great deal about Turkey. You know a great deal about Hungary. What did you think about this? Is there anything substantive?
Are you asking me about my personal feelings?
No. Do you think there's anything?
My personal feelings about this meeting is that this was a publicity stunt.
It seems like this, right?
It coincided with the fact that Hungary is host to the World Athletic Championships.
Right.
And this was the opening day. On the 20th, which was yesterday, on Sunday, this is the national day in Hungary, the anniversary of the foundation of the right. Hungarian state in the 11th century. Okay.
What a coincidence.
So they all crammed it all together and they wanted to show that they have some high profile visitors, and not just for the games, but also doing some substantial security and political stuff.
Right.
So yes. There was a cabinet meeting with Erdogan, and you know they discussed gas supplies mm-hmm. through the pipelines going through Turkey. For Hungary, this is important because Hungary is one of the countries that is making the slowest progress in diversifying away from Russian supplies. Mm-hmm. So, and some analysts, and we've written about this on Visegrad Insight, our fellow Martin L. wrote an article about that some of the Central European countries, such as Hungary, Austria, and also Slovakia to some degree, they're too slow with their diversification. So yes, there is some substance in the meeting. But if you consider the fact that the government spokesman published pictures of Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, meeting important people from the world, and there were three ex-prime ministers, Erdogan and it was a bit of a publicity stunt to try to convince everyone that Hungary is not isolated. While in fact Hungary is not totally isolated. No country in the world is totally, maybe except for North Korea, mm-hmm. is totally isolated. But certainly the sort of list of significant allies isn't so great. So obviously this relationship with Turkey is important for Hungary. It's probably worth mentioning here that both leaders, Erdogan and Orban, seem to share a certain view of how government should be conducted, right. with little respect for the opposition and some basic tenets of sort of democratic debate. So they have both displayed authoritarian tendencies. So there may be some personal connection there.
Right.
But at the end of the day, most of it was for show.
Yeah, it showed us particularly who Orban does consider his close friends, allies, and so forth.
Yeah, among them was Sebastian Kurz, who just 2 days ago was charged by Austrian prosecutors. Here you go.
So it tells you. Great. Thank you so much, Adam. We have a lot of developments happening this week. Now we'll move on to the interview portion of the podcast.
Leszek, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Wojtek. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're also very glad to host you for the first time, I think. And also, it was a pleasure to have a conversation with you for the podcast of the European Liberal Forum some time ago about European strategic autonomy. And I think it's worth to continue the discussion. So we are ahead of the announcement of the European strategic agenda draft points, which will happen under the Spanish presidency in October. Spanish presidency will organize events on open strategic autonomy of the European Union. But I wanted to pick your brain and your sense of how much can this term be on one side contagious politically, but on the other side, how much can it be useful to describe the strategies and where Europe should go in the next half a year, of course, in the context of the war in Ukraine, but again, strategically, meaning for a decade maybe to come.
Well, thank you, Wojciech, first of all, for inviting me to Visegrad Insights podcast. I'm a happy subscriber, and I'm following what you guys have been doing. And it's a really good question, to be honest, because I think on one hand, you see that the fact that Spanish presidency not refraining from discussing and even deepening the strategic thinking on now I think the term, as you said, is open strategic autonomy. Germans perhaps would prefer strategic sovereignty. That means that at least in some parts of Europe, I think that Josep Borrell is also deeply engaged in, well, obviously it's a Spanish presidency, that especially in the southern and the western parts of the continent, this is still the term that seems to be valid. Of course, for now, because of the Joe Biden, it doesn't seem that urgent, but this is still a lens through which a big part of the pro-European establishments, also security establishments, prefers to discuss the future, the strategic future of Europe. While at the same time, obviously, the fact that the American leadership in the war, in the Ukraine defense is indisputable, and nobody, even France, is sort of opposing this American leadership. Germans are basically waiting for Americans to react, to do anything, to send any weapons. And of course, in the Eastern Europe, which became much more important, also militarily, that term seems to be, well, disputable at least. And I think in many ways it seemed in the past. Now, I don't think that actually this discussion is going on. I don't think that anyone is seriously discussing, maybe except you or maybe some intellectual circles, but I mean in political circles. I don't think that strategic autonomy is even seriously being considered in the Eastern Europe. And that means that we have a big divergence in terms of the framework. I'm not 100% sure that it necessarily means that we are in the essence so far away. Of course, there are reasons to doubt when French are raising this issue of strategic autonomy, because it's autonomy from what? From whom? It's obviously it's Americans. And our biggest problem is not too much of Americans in Europe. It's basically perhaps not enough of American support. And it's, of course, the Russia is a key issue. So yeah, I see this divergence, and I think that might be an issue that I don't really believe that, especially in the current circumstances, this strategic insights that Spanish presidency wants to prepare, even though some of them are really meaningful. I think especially, you know, that energy is one of the priorities, and it's absolutely, after the experiences of the last year, it's absolutely the essential issue to be discussed. But I don't think that without a deeper, perhaps intellectual, meaningful discussion, what we actually mean by the open strategic autonomy. And if you agree on the challenges that lie ahead, I think that will be very, very hard to actually employ this term in a way that both sides of the continent work in unison.
Yeah, there are very few voices in Central Eastern Europe who would eagerly pick up the theme, and especially during the electoral campaign, even the voices of the liberal side or the left wing are more timid. They're not necessarily raising this as an issue, but the issue is there. The discussion about how Europe will go on, especially that across the pond, we see Donald Trump having fair chances of standing ahead Joe Biden in terms of popularity, in terms of his advantage in the Republican camp. That's going to be probably the main candidate in the U.S. The debate on strategic autonomy that has been politically revived during Trump's presidency long ago seems to be just about to happen. And I wanted to ask and pick your brain on, you know, how do you see the reactions to what has been changing since we last also talked? And that was a couple of months ago. We were before Germany announced their plan for the security strategy that later was amended by this chapter on China. There was the whole announcement also of the EU about de-risking China. And a lot of effort has been put also in the military sector, military and defense sector. I think that those fears of lack of American leadership may be actually reviving the whole discussion about Europe, where Europe should go. Don't you agree? In a way, you know, the fear of Donald Trump coming back and what would Europe do? That might actually help push things forward. Do you think it's possible in the context specifically of Central Eastern Europe?
Yeah, well, I think absolutely. This is what happens before, even if you know, it was before the war. That's fortunately that Trump was the president. But yeah, I'm 100% sure that the short-sightedness on, let's say, in our region, that's this American engagement will last forever. The Chinese conflict that you mentioned is essential. In the end, if you look at the security strategy of US, this is the China, this is the main strategic threat. The Russia is sort of divergence, but is not perceived as strategic threat to the United States. And we have to, I mean, any defense strategy, any procurements that we have for deliveries of the weapons and so on, they are looking forward like 10, 20 years ahead. And I think that in many ways, the problem was that the term strategic autonomy got this anti-American bias. Why it could be very useful if we think about how Europe wants to define itself, how it wants to define the threats, how it wants to define the challenges and also the ways in which those challenges can be approached. And I don't know if we have to keep the term. To be honest, for me, this is just a tool for achieving something greater, a strategic Europe. I think this should be the goal. And if we're going to put more words, open and insightful strategic autonomy or sovereignty, I don't really think it makes any sense or it's worth discussing. For me, it will be a question, okay, do we as European Union, for me, it will be a key question, not the sort of Macron's antics or against US, or he likes to provoke and well, it's his right, but I don't think it's very useful for the president to play such a role. For me, it's a question, okay, regardless of what US wants from us, how we as citizens of European Union, how do we think about China? Do we feel it's a player that could be trusted in the global world order? And I think Germany, you mentioned the recent update of their strategy. They were surprisingly skeptical towards Chinese. I don't think they want to repeat the same mistakes as they did. Of course, not everyone in Germany, right? Because the connection, the business connection, the industry is so dependent on China, on the exports. And also to some extent the imports. So that will be a big question. Okay, as Europeans, how do we feel about China playing the more important role on the global stage? Do we want to live in a world shaped by China? And I think even just in the recent Foreign Affairs, Mark Lenard, who famously wrote the book How EU Would Rule the World 20 years ago, now he wrote an essay about China being very confident in a world in which the disorder rules, and that for Americans is much a bigger challenge. And I think for Japan, for European Union, the disorder is also a big threat. So for me, it's sort of obvious that more strategic Europe wouldn't necessarily align with the United States on everything. It could think independently, but in many ways, more strategic Europe, for example, would be able to challenge the security threats on its own continent, like in the Western Balkans in the past or Ukraine. We don't seem to be able and even thinking about it, how we could possibly do it without Americans. So yes, I think that with Trump or without Trump, hopefully without Trump, perhaps Trump was the crisis that we needed to start thinking seriously about our own strategic autonomy. I do wish that we have this insightfulness, that we understand, okay, even without Trump, the next US Democratic president, let's say in the 5 years time, wouldn't be a Joe Biden. He's really old. He's really a Cold Warrior, right, from the old times. Anyone in his 40s or 50s, on her 40s or 50s, would think completely in a completely different way. In the Pacific is the key word. It is the Atlantic of the 1970s or 1960s. So yeah, we have to be prepared. And I wish that we, especially Poland is a key player in the region, we'll be able to sort of find the middle ground with France and Germany to think strategically about Europe, dropping the term employing the term, we can discuss it, but definitely finding a common ground on and think about strategic Europe.
I think you're quite right to observe that the number of European countries, European Union member states, are looking into new strategies, how to cope with the world. I just wonder how much of that is essentially the countries are starting to look inward. And in the continental Europe, it seems like a similar trend. I wonder whether that's that trend of inward looking, so kind of that projects in foreign policy type of isolationism, is really giving us a potential to build some sovereignty, some power, some strategy, or it's more, you know, it's more de-risking in a sense. It's just escaping from the biggest challenges that are on us anyway.
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I think it's, in a way, we have been defined as sort of the West, right? I don't know if this term is still used, but usually in the quotes. But it's been about openness. It's been about engagement. It's been about reaching out. It's been about globalization, opening markets, and so on. And I think since Obama time, since the financial crisis, it's been more and more about closing, recently about the risking, especially COVID. I think it was a sort of wake up call that dependence in some essential goods on China and in general, external players is dangerous. It's not just about defense, but it's also about, you know, masks and pharmaceuticals. It's a very complex question. So, because we have on one, you said, because this inward looking Europe is, I think, very much a product of the times in which we see interdependence as a threat, not as an opportunity. Before, we really believed, to be honest, I was sort of skeptical, but it was hard not to believe that, okay, engaging China makes absolute sense in terms of transforming China. The Russia, I think that this idea of Germany that you can transform Russia through trade has been until the war, even after Crimea, it's been still the idea that was the driving force behind many initiatives, including Nord Stream 2. So I think the Xi Jinping and the war in Ukraine and before the COVID, they sort of pushed everyone, including Americans, who, you know, with the IRA, it's basically perhaps the biggest push against open markets, and especially about the common market in Europe. I don't think that it would be without a reaction on behalf of the European Union. It's very hard to think how competitive EU can be in terms of the green energy. But on the other hand, we cannot do the tax breaks and subsidies on the scale that Americans do, because we don't tax on there's not like a federal tax in the European Union, right? So it's much more complex and possibly really threatening for the internal cohesion of the European Union, meaning that rich countries can actually defend their investment in a much better way. And I'm not surprised we're in a more defensive mood. So we are not really thinking now about spreading democracy. We're really thinking about keeping democracy at home in many countries. In some countries, as Hungary, I'm afraid we're failing. Hopefully, we will manage to keep it in Poland. So this is a defensive mood. Perhaps this is the relative power of the West, including EU, has gone down. Definitely the US power towards EU. You know, the US was a relatively smaller economy than EU was in 2008. Yes, we are becoming smaller, but if you think about the role that EU can play, we could be thinking about punching above our weight. I think that in the way that Britain did for the long time until the Brexit. And because it's very much a question of the imagination of the elites, I think. It's very much a question of the sort of global diplomacy, a prestige, soft power or smart power, you know, according to Joseph Nye. So we are not having this. We have some initiatives which are very much not aligned with each other. You mentioned before the visit of Macron, there was a parallel visit of von der Leyen, and they spoke with different languages. I don't mean that spoke French and German, they spoke basically different strategic languages. And this is we are like weak enough in comparison to the really well-organized military powers, rising powers, and US. If we don't get our potential like aligns, we are not going to get this. Of course, we might, you know, be sort of declining power for quite a long time, but we are not going to shape the world in a way that is going to be profitable for us. We are going to be, especially in AI, you see that we basically can regulate, okay, that's fine, but if you don't offer anything, that means that you basically have to depend on the external players. It's dangerous. We see it's dangerous. In the COVID times, it's a question of life and death. And I think with AI and different new technologies will be the same.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Freedom Games, and by all means, all listeners who drop by or pass by Poland or want to come to Poland should definitely visit Freedom Games, organized by Leszek Jarzewski and Liberté in Łódź. Some hour drive from Warsaw.
Please do. Thank you, Wojtek.
in a big and fascinating city of Łódź. But also, I think I need to counter you on a couple of facts. I think GDP, China is not even close to US, according to the research we're able to find. It might be not even close to Japan yet. It depends how you, I mean, it depends all if you really trust the data provided by the state agencies of China and Beijing. Why I'm mentioning that was the chatter, and the chatter, I think, is just starting from research, academic research in Chicago, and I think economists started to follow up on the threat that actually the economy of China doesn't perform so well and doesn't seem to be as promising as it used to be. But I agree with you that Europe, most of the European Union, most of the time displays this defensive mood, and the defensive mood, even in the areas which are innovation, which is AI, seems to be the future in terms of economy, but also in terms of military approach, because AI eventually is going to, if not already, has not been militarized. And the question, my last question to you, which still revolves around the same idea of this strategic autonomy of source or European Union power, this needs to be defined somehow as a power to disrupt, to change status quo by employing some sort of a European Union will. And if you were to dream, or if you were to, you know, think out of the box, where would you see this elements of future European Union power to disrupt the world in a positive sense, hopefully, but in a way showing and displaying that EU may change the things and others have to lean in?
I think about it all the time, to be honest. And you know, one thing is to theorize, and then you have to, you know, run in the elections, defend your economy, and, you know, do 50 things at the same time. And I think the only Macron has this ambition to actually transform Europe. I don't think that necessarily always in the right direction, but at least I appreciate the his initiative. So internally, I would say that European Union has to come to terms with their own nations. I do think that nations could be an internal revival of European Union. I think that in some ways, European experience could be very useful in thinking how the post-globalization world might look like. I mean, post-globalization, what I mean is that we won't have like one big, you know, world's open, I mean, of course, it doesn't really exist, but I mean, at least ideologically, we'll have more and more, let's say, regions or overlapping difference. And I think that European Union is a good example of how putting together different sorts of overlapping systems, if you combine them and if you manage to offer enough incentives for participants, that means that you can build quite coherent, I wouldn't say perfectly coherent, but quite coherent and quite powerful in terms of regulating internal affairs of the actors who play bodies, which in the end also play an important role.
Oh, that's interesting. The real interesting thing is how I think you skillfully omitted the question of defense and army and projecting power, the hard power that Europe or European Union is now most challenged with. And I think We'll have to deal with this problem, but maybe we can do it separately at another conversation, because that's a whole new new ballgame, and really, really something that, that needs to be observed. And I believe, without answering to this question of sort of you know, on what terms is European Union willing to commit to lethal use of force, or at least continued provision of lethal force for the others in Europe, like Ukraine and in Africa, then perhaps we will be missing one key important element to which the other powers that we're maybe competing with are certainly responsive and have their own agenda and have their own answers. But now, Leszek, thank you very much for taking time and talking for our listeners, having this conversation with me. Again, let's invite everyone to Freedom Games. Tell us in one sentence what the Freedom Games this year are all about.
It's a turning point. It's a turning point for democracy, for economy, for the continent. So yeah, absolutely. Please come. Thank you, Wojtek. And I hope that also you accept our invitation. But most of all, thank you for the inspiring conversation as always. So I'm really looking forward to the future conversation as well. Thank you.
Thanks.